to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction novel that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. Now, I'm not going to get into any feedback or news or anything this time around, because I think what this book is, I think this review is going to run long. Well, maybe not long. I've just got quite a lot to say about the novel that I'm going to review in this episode, so I'm just going to get straight into it. So, the book I'm reviewing is by Robert J. Sawyer, who is a Canadian science fiction author from Canada. And he wrote a book in Canada called Calculating God. And the reason I'm reading this is because I always like to give a Canadian author, a second chance when I'm reading. And, you know, if I read a book of theirs that I don't like, the idea is that it might just be an off book, or it might just be a book that I didn't really enjoy so much, and then I'll read another book by theirs and really, really enjoy it. I mean, this happened with a few authors now on this podcast. There was this, was it John Varley? I read and really, really hated Red Thunder, and then read another one of his books. I think it was called Steel Beach, you know, from, you know, that was from different recommendations from people, and I was saying, is there a better book by this guy? And everyone said, yeah, that one, and I read it and really enjoyed it. And that's happened a few times over the course of this podcast and over the course of my general reading history as well. So I thought I'd give Calculating God another Robert J. Sawyer book. And this was specifically because someone said, oh, this is one of his better books. There are other books that people recommended, but I thought, hey, I'll give this one a go. And so, yeah, give it a second chance. The strange thing is, if I'd have read this book first, Calculating God, let me just bring up the Goodreads page about this. Let me just click on it here. Okay, yeah, so it was published 2001, first published 2000, and it's around about 338 pages, so not a big thick novel, and quite a recent one as well. But Hominids, I know, is a more recent novel than that, but if I'd have read Hominids first, or if I'd have read this first, I would have thought Hominids would just be like a cheap, like a rough knockoff of this book, or maybe, you know, the other way around, because that's what you sort of think, because they are very similar in different ways. And I'm not quite sure why someone thought I would enjoy this book when I'd read Hominids and not enjoyed that book at all. In fact, actually, I think with my Hominids review, that was the time, it was like a year and a half ago when I read that, and I was really ill at the time. I was I had a trapped nerve in my spine, and I was on a lot of drugs. And then I did that review, and it got a lot of good feedback. Although I don't think I've ever actually, maybe I did listen to it back one time, but I should get to it really. So this book, I was finding it a bit strange. And the other night on Friday night, I was listening to it. I wasn't listening to it. I was around at the local bookshop and chatting to the people there, and I was talking about listening to audiobooks. And someone, and I got it out, and I was saying, yeah, look, because I can, if I want to listen to it, if I want to get through the book quickly, I can listen to it at 2x speed, because on the iPhone you can, or the iPods, you can actually listen to stuff at a faster speed. And that's what I do sometimes, you know, if I'm just wanting to get through something, I'll listen to it on a faster speed. And so I pointed out the book. I said it wasn't actually a very good book. And someone sitting next to me, this girl sitting next to me, she said, well, any novel with that image on the cover must be terrible. And it's one of the images, the most famous image from the roof of the Sistine, or the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, with, you know, God creating Adam with the two fingers coming out and touching there. I mean, she is a theology lecturer at the Berlin University, but it was quite interesting to hear her review of the book just based on the novel, and on the cover of the novel. Anyway, so let's get into it. The world is, it's in Canada, and as we know, Canada is the center of the world. We know that from the book Hominids. But it's not really the center of the world. It's just that, of course, because, you know, Robert J. Sawyer is from Canada. He really, really wants everything to happen in Canada. And it is, of course, one of the most important places in the world, even if it's not quite. But then, you know, aliens visit and they turn up in a few places around the world. And one place that they turn up is in Toronto with the Royal Ontario Museum. So like a natural history museum, or part of it's a natural history museum kind of thing. And so that's really where the book is set. Although it's not really the world of the book, it's just sort of like this setting which is described in detail again and again and again and again and again. Now, a bit strange, like I was saying before, how this book is a little bit of a rerun from Hominids. There is actually some different people described in the book Hominids. Some of them are Canadians, but there's two other nationalities mentioned in, or two other nationalities of different characters mentioned in Hominids. One of them is Jamaican and another guy is a Sikh. And in this book, the only two characters that we meet who live in work in the university there, not in the university, in the museum there. One of them is Jamaican and the other one is Sikh. And I'm thinking, is that really what Toronto is like? Is that really what Canada is like? Is it just, you know, Canadians, some Americans, and then Jamaicans and Sikhs? But that seems to be what we have there as well. Anyway, lots of stuff going on in the museum. It's just, like I said, it's described over and over again. And the main character in the book, and it's like a first-person narrative. So the main character, he works there. He's a paleontologist called Tom. But he's always talking about how it's really bad there, you know, and it's like, oh, it's terrible because they're turning it into a tourist attraction. It's becoming an attraction that should be a place of study. It should be a place of scholarship, should be a place of science. Oh, but it's being made into an attraction. And he's really annoyed about that. And I thought this was going to pay off later on in the book, that because this, you know, this alien has come down to visit, he's turned up, he wants to see a paleontologist, he wants to see some fossils. And apparently the Royal Ontario Museum has got like this massive fossil collection, which is like, you know, unparalleled around the world. I'm thinking, because that must be the reason why the alien has visited, surely, you know, because he's visiting Canada and not all the other places in the world where you can get lots of fossils in one place. Anyway, so he goes there, and I was thinking, okay, because the Royal Ontario Museum is described so much in this book, you know, it's all about the museum all the time. It's sort of like, oh yeah, we went into this room and this was in this room, and then we went through into that room, and then we saw that fossil and this fossil and that fossil, and went through and watched this display and that display. I was thinking this would actually have some kind of impact on the story or some payoff at the end, you know, like Night at the Museum. And they do all this thing, and the museum isn't doing very well. Not so many people are coming along there to the Natural History Museum in New York. And then at the end of the movie, I'm not giving it away too much, but at the end of the movie, loads of people start coming along because there's been newsworthy events taking place there, and suddenly everyone's heard about it on the news, and everyone turns up, and it's really great, and it suddenly becomes what the person wants it to be, and that's, you know, the star of the film wants it to be, and that's, like, more successful and things. You know, it's a payoff. Whereas here, what we do, we just have, like, all this loads and loads of descriptions about Toronto and Canada and the museum, but there's no payoff at the end because that's not what the book is about, and yet we just get it over and over and over again. Also, Robert J. Sawyer, he always talks about, you know, he puts in lots of popular culture references. There's lots of sort of makes of cars, you know, this car hit that car, and then this happened, then that happened, then things like that. And also there's quite a lot of like film references as well, and it's a bit strange, but you know, it's very much grounded in the real world. And that's, I think, what it's meant to be, is being grounded in this world. And this is it, you know, because there's Star Trek references and things like that. Oh, actually, the Star Trek references is a bit weird because this science fiction isn't very good. And if you're going to reference other science fiction like Star Trek, you've really got to make sure that your quality, or the quality of the science fiction that you're talking about in your novel, has to be at least as good as Star Trek science fiction. Or else it's probably best not to reference other things. Also, there's lots of references to other scientists, you know, because in the introduction to the novel, which I actually listened to after I'd listened to the novel, Robert J. Sawyer talks about how his main character is a bit like Carl Sagan and these other sort of big kind of like science superstars, you know, these science popularizers, these sort of like atheistic, you know, kind of worldview kind of guys as well, which is actually, to be honest, I'm glad I listened to the introduction afterwards, because if I'd have listened to it beforehand, I probably wouldn't have listened to the book at all, mainly because Robert J. Sawyer, his reading voice is so kind of like that I really wanted to just punch him in the mouth. So what was he saying? Oh yeah, he was saying, yeah, about this and about that and about, you know, he puts all of these different, you know, cultural references in there as well. So getting onto the story, I can't really spoil the plot because there isn't much of a plot, so I'll just go with the plot. What happens is an alien turns up. It's a big spider kind of alien called Horus. I think it's actually called Hollis, but I was always thinking Horus because for me, like, I always pictured this sort of spider thing in mind, and when I was young, I played this game on my ZX Spectrum called Horus and the Spiders, and there was Horus Goes Skiing as well, and Horus is this, like, alien monster. So now, if someone's called anything that sounds a little bit like Horus, all I could think of was Horus. So there's Horus for the rest of this review, I'll call it that. Him that, her that, whatever, we'll get to that later. So anyway, what happens is that Horace comes down and he wants to see some fossils, and Canada has this fossil collection, so that's it. And it turns out this alien has visited lots of other planets, and a very interesting thing that we find out right at the very beginning of the book is that Earth has had five main extinction events over the last 500 million years that we can keep track of, you know, and it goes through them. It's this, and, you know, that's the first question that the alien asks, is like, what about these whole, you know, what about all these extinction events? And so, you know, Tom, the paleontologist that he meets, says, okay, there's this one and this one, this one, this one, this one. And the alien says, hey, check it out. Did you know that on our planet, we also had five extinction events over the course of our, you know, biological history? And they happened all at the same time. And guess what? And there's another planet that we visited as well. Their extinction events also happened all at the same time. Like, if you work it out to Earth years, they all happened at the same time. And I was thinking, hey, this is a really, really good idea. However, almost immediately at the beginning of the book, the alien says, ah, and this proves that God exists. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, no, this proves that God exists and that he is guiding evolution as he goes along. And immediately I thought, well, actually, no, that isn't what it means. All it means is that there's either some, you know, other thing that, you know, we have some correlation there, but then there has to be some other causation to it. And the causation, you can't just suddenly say God does it, even though immediately he says, ah, Occam's razor says that the simplest explanation has to be true. And he goes, well, God did it, and that's the truest, simplest explanation. And the scientist is like, yeah, I guess. Anyway, what happens then is about the next 7/8 of the book is a conversation between Horace, the alien, and Tom, the paleontologist. And they talk about creationism and evolution and morality and ethics and philosophy and all these different things like that. Now, other things do happen in the book, but these other things that happen in the book are pretty much despite any effort or goals or motivations or anything from these two main players, these two main characters in the book. In a way, just like the novel Hominids by Robert J. Sawyer, set in Canada. And because there, they have this big, long conversation between this Neanderthal geneticist and a Neanderthal, and they talk about religion and, you know, society and all these other kinds of things going on there, and they just sit there and talk. Meanwhile, other stuff happens, and at the end of the book, stuff happens to them or because of them, and, you know, nothing actually, they're not actually doing anything at all. And in this book, there's not a lot of doing. There's a lot of talking backwards and forwards and things like that. Now, it could be good, you know, I don't mind a novel or a story which is just two people talking back, you know, talking to each other. However, the stuff that does happen is sort of like clunk. It falls clunk in there, like a clunk, just one clunk after another thing, you know. Like, for example, there's this whole scene, suddenly, like, everything's in first-person narrative, and then suddenly, at one point, we suddenly get this third-person narrative of these two guys who they bombed some abortion clinic or something. Oh, no, we read in the news, hey, there's been a bombing at an abortion clinic, and I was literally thinking, okay, here we go. Now we have the alien going, ah, what is this abortion you think of? And it literally just go clunk. It goes clunk. It goes, oh, oh, what does abortion actually mean? I've heard it talked about in the news, but what does it actually mean, says the alien. And then we have this clunk kind of clunk discussion about it. And then we get some action, you know, a bit later, and then later on. But what happens is that these, you know, this thing comes up. This thing comes up with these abortion clinic bombers, these fundamentalist Christians and things. And then they do something which isn't driven by the main characters, and then fizzles out with no consequences at all to anybody involved, any of the main characters involved, and then that plot line just disappears again. I'm like, wait a second. It was just such a random encounter, which really added nothing to the book, except, I think, to say, like, for Robert J. Sawyer to say, oh, yeah, look, I'm talking about creationism and things like that, but I'm not a fundamentalist Christian, you know, because they're these wackos who, these guys kill abortion doctors, and I don't. You know, and that seems to be the only point of that whole subplot going on there. So then at the end of the book, I might as well, I'm not going to give away the end of the book, but there's this massive coincidence, which actually came as no surprise, because Robert J. Sawyer, he works in three modes with his fiction. He works in plot mode, he works in character mode, and he works in philosophical discussion, debate mode. And they never mix. So when we have like some character thing with Tom doing, you know, going about his life, that's it. We don't have any story there at all. It's just his character. When we have discussions, that's all we have, discussions. And then when something else happens, you realize, oh, wait a second, this doesn't fit into the character piece and it doesn't fit into the theme piece. This has to pay off later. You know, like the abortion clinic bombers, and it's sort of like, okay, well, we can see where this is going, and it's like, and then one point the alien goes, oh, I've got to be here on Sunday evening, and we already know that on Sunday evening the abortion clinic people are going to come and shoot up or bomb the museum, and it's sort of like clunk, 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 clunk. Oh, yeah, So what did I make a note of here? Oh, yeah. This is how inane the plotting is. So at one point, these abortion clinic guys, I can give away this plot because it doesn't actually have any impact on the book at all. So they're planning to go and blow up this university thing. I'm not going to give away why, you know, well, it doesn't matter why, but that's what they're going to do. So anyway, what happens at one point, this has got what I'm going to say now has got nothing to do with what the main characters are doing. Someone phones the police and say, hey, I found a gun in my hotel. You better come and check it out. So two policemen go over to the hotel room of these two abortion clinic bombers, and they find there some, you know, this gun case which holds an assault rifle and another gun. And also they find a map, and on the map the abortion clinic bombers have circled the abortion clinic. And they've circled the museum and a few other places of interest in Toronto at the same time. And I was just like, is this actually happened? It's like, Robert J. Sawyer, do you actually believe that these people would bomb a clinic, stay in the same city that they've bombed the clinic, keep an assault weapon thing in their, like, assault weapon case in their hotel room, knowing that someone's going to be coming in to clean the rooms, and leaving a map saying, we are here. And then, of course, the police go off and try to find these abortion clinic bombers at the university or at the local, you know, TV station or at the sports stadium. They go off and do that. And then what it does, it comes down to it, that when they actually get there, in the end, the police, that whole police thing, what they're doing there, doesn't have any consequences, because what happens is that when they get there, the guy calls 911 anyway, and that's how the police come along. So that whole kind of thing is just like this whole stupid, inane clunk of this sort of, like, this plot. Oh, yeah, the police go along and they discover, oh, look, they're going to bomb this. Oh, they're going to shoot that. Oh, it's so terrible. And then they just turn up, go, well, they're not at the museum. And then leave again. And then they have to call the police in anyway. So the police are completely ineffectual. The bombers are completely ineffectual. And it's just pathetic. Anyway, so what was I saying? Oh, yeah. So that's all. You can, any time that anything like that happens, you can tell what's going to happen. You can tell it's going to pay off and stuff like that. Because, like you say, Sawyer, he works in plot mode. He works in character mode and philosophical discussion mode. And that's it, you know. The ending is just stupid. Although there is this big... It's a bit weird to complain about this in a book which is about discovering God and contemplating God and trying to find God and things like that. But there is a Deus Ex Machina at the end. But then again, it's sort of like it's needed to prove that God exists, because that's the only way that you can actually do that, is to literally go, oh, something bad's going to happen. Oh, but God makes it all worked out. And it's like, well, is it God? Well, it was a Deus Ex Machina. Oh, but it isn't, because that's what the book is about. And I'm just like, it's just seriously, but yeah. And actually, that whole thing at the end of the book is a complete coincidence, which again has nothing to do with the aliens, with Tom, the main character. It's just something that happens. And of course, you know, the main characters sort of work out why it's happened or what's happening there at all. But even if they hadn't worked it out, it would have happened anyway. And nothing that they do affect actually what does happen with this big event at the end of the book anyway, which again, don't really want to give that too much away, because I've given away, well, I can't, you can't give away the book, because literally there's no story for 7/8 of the book, and then at the end there's a bit of story again. So moving on to the, oh yeah, let me just say, the plot, like I say, really, really bad, just all over the place and stupid. The characters, Tom is a scientist. He is a paleontologist. He's really, you know, he's really into dinosaurs. That's what he is. He's like one of the best dinosaur people in the world. Maybe, I don't know. It's all in first-person narrative, so you're never actually quite sure what's going on here at all. But he's one of the most, for a scientist, he's one of the most incurious scientists in the world ever. One of the most stupid, and one of the scientists with the least grasp of his own, with his own discipline as well. But to go to the incurious point, like, in the first conversation that he has with an alien, okay, it goes like this. Alien, what are you doing here? I'm here, I want to have a look at fossils. Oh, why do you want to have a look at fossils? Because we're trying to prove that God exists. Oh, well, let's now have a long conversation about God. And it's like, do you not care that there's, like, an alien in the room with you. An alien ask questions. Where are you from? What are you doing here? What are you going on? What's going on here? Tell me about it. And the alien's going, Tom goes, oh yeah, about these planets. It were the nine planets. And the alien goes, not nine planets, 10 planets. Keep looking. And he's like, okay. So we were saying before about God. And I'm like, no, wait a second. Go back one. 10 planets? What's going on here? Like, he's just told you there's another planet orbiting the sun, and you're not even going to ask, like, oh, where is that planet? We've been looking, you know, we've always checked for this other planet. You know, we've been checking all the time. What's it, whereabouts is it? I'll call my astronomer friend. You know, there's a guy, an astronomer, in the building. We've already established that because it'll be helpful later on in the plot, but we know there's an astronomy department here as well. So I'll bring in him, and then you can tell him where the extra planet is. You know, that could have happened. And then at one point, the alien's going, ah, okay, well, you think there's only four fundamental forces of nature. You know, there's gravity and, you know, the weak magnet, the weak electrical force, strong electrical force, and, you know, electromagnetism, all this, you know, whatever they are. And he says, actually, there's not four, there's five. And this proves that there's only ever been eight universes in the world in this cycle of crunching and, you know, expanding and contracting universes, and we're universe number eight. And Tom is like, oh yeah, great, so that does prove God exists. But it's, he doesn't go, oh, wait a second, let's go back up. I work at a major university here in Canada, which is like, I mean, this is probably one of the biggest and most amazing natural history museums in the world here in Toronto. And I'm sure I'll be able to call up, you know, I'll call up, you know, and call up some Nobel laureates, you know, this, you know, and Stephen Hawking and all these other guys, you know, and tell you what, we'll ask them, we'll ask you to explain this fifth fundamental, you know, force of nature to them, and we'll really get, you know, we'll really get stuff sorted out here. But he doesn't do that. He's just like, oh, there's five of them. He's like, ah, look, we thought it was four, you know, ah, silly us. And, you know, and he talks about, you know, and Horace talks about this grand unifying theory of everything. And I'm, it's just time and time again, I was like, why isn't Tom just like picking him up on these? It's like, okay, I know you want to talk about God and fossils and stuff, but you know, what's really important to us here on Earth is like, hey, you know, like the fifth fundamental force of nature, that could be coming really handy to our science at the moment. But you know, he just skips over it all as well. Also, Tom is a bit sneering at people who aren't scientifically literate. You know, I was talking about before how, you know, he's always like going, oh, I can't believe this museum where I work and where I've got my, like, amazing job. It's absolutely amazing, my job. It's really, oh, I can't be bothered to work here, you know, because people have to turn up and people are just stupid. And this was what really annoyed me about, like, the sneering attitude towards, like, scientifically illiterate people. And again, I do think more people should be cleverer or more intelligent, but you know, for a lot of people it's not that important. You know, in hominids though, as someone used the word irregardless, and it's like, oh, I can't believe you used the word irregardless, you know. And this book is, he talks about the indignity of using electric faucets when he's washing his hands after going to the bathroom. I'm like, get over it. And he's got this adopted son. Tom's got adopted son. He's like, oh, I really couldn't, I'm not quite sure if I could relate to him if he wasn't as smart as he was. I'm like, you adopted a kid. It's like, What kind of human are you where you're like actually saying, oh man, I'm so glad my kid is he's really clever. I'm not sure if I could love him if he wasn't really clever. And I'm just like going, for goodness sake, like, you don't, sure, you can think that, but it's like, don't tell us it about it in the story. Tell you what, try and come off as some, like, slightly human in some way. So anyway, by the end of the novel, let's just get straight to it here. Tom is mostly convinced that the existence of God. Now, we, like, learned earlier on that he'd, like, debated creationists in the past. However, nothing in the book that we learn about is actually any more convincing than what a creationist would say, and they haven't really convinced any of these top scientists. You know, like, every time that Carl Sagan was debating, actually I don't know how many he did debate with, you know, but all of these, like, scientific minds, you know, all of the debates that they've ever had with any creationist, how many times have a creationist ever changed the mind of a scientist? You know, it's like 0.00000001% of all the people who have ever had a conversation about creationism. Now, this book doesn't actually talk about anything in any more depth than just like a very basic creationist kind of debate. And me, as a non-scientist, can just see through everything in this book as just, you know, the bullshit that it is. And yet Tom, who is this amazing guy who, in a quite straw man kind of way, Robert J. Sawyer is trying to hold up there as a Carl Sagan kind of figure, like saying, oh yeah, this is the kind of guy Carl Sagan was like. It's like, well, Carl Sagan would never talk about, you know, he would never be convinced with what happens here, you know, what the arguments are being put across. Now, Carl Sagan did write a book called Contact, and again, I never actually finished the book, but I saw the film, and that's, you know, it was a lot about I know in the book as well, it talks a lot about discovering God and all that kind of stuff, again, it's not really the same kind of thing. That was a scientific pursuit that was looking at God from a scientific point of view. It's like, if God did create the universe, how could we prove it? And, you know, one of the ideas is, I think in the book, is when he tries to find messages to us in, like, mathematical messages to us in, like, irrational numbers. Not irrational numbers. What are they? I can't remember the exact kind of the numbers that they're talking about there, because I am not a scientist or mathematician. But, you know, it's that kind of thing. And here it's just pathetic, because it literally goes, oh, yeah, you know, irreducible complexity. Isn't that weird? And they're like, going, oh, yeah, I'll get more into that later. Anyway, so, yeah, Tom, what's this main character? Oh, yeah, he's dying from lung cancer. Did I mention that before? No, I didn't, because it has nothing to do with the plot. The only thing that leads to is much introspection and many sort of, like, saccharine moments with his, like, adopted son. It's like, son, I'm going to die. Do you have to die, Daddy? Yeah, I'm going to die. Oh, why? Well, you know, it's this whole cancer. Daddy, did you do anything wrong in a previous life and now you've got cancer? No, it's not like that. And I'm just like, oh, for goodness sake. Again, it's not... it's just so weird then. Oh, yeah, the alien, very generic alien. And we have to spend a lot of time with this alien, him, her. Oh, this is another example of, like, how incurious Tom is. He didn't even ask any personal questions about the alien. It's not even like, hey, what's your world like? You know, never ask that. Hey, what about this? What's your society like? What kind of government you have? Well, that's not important, is it? Even to the point of like, hey, what's it like to be an alien? Do you have a family? And Horace would have gone, yeah, I do. I have got 3 children and a husband. And I'm like, wait, back up. You mean you're male? It like takes 3/4 of the book before before Tom. He's never been curious to ask actually what, you know, what sexual orientation or sex Horace is. And it's like, it takes all that time to find out that it's a female. And and it also has kids and stuff, but we never find out about that. So it's a real pity how we got this very, very vague, very, like, generic alien. But I think can't help but thinking in one way that it's so vague and generic because Tom, as this scientist, he's so bound up in his own life. It's like, oh, woe is me, I have cancer. Oh, and my job isn't very good. And I've got to work with this boss who is more interested in making the museum financially viable and a success for the general public than I am, because I just want to get on with looking at fossils and stuff like that. And I'm just thinking, this is like one of the most self-centered, like incurious guys that we never find out anything about the alien. But then again, that's because Robert J. Sawyer is so self-centered and, I can't say self-centered, but his, you know, his writing is so, like, single topic that actually what he wants to do is have a discussion between. He says this in the introduction. It's like, hey, what would it be like if we have, like, an atheist human and is visited by a theistic alien? It's like, normally it's the atheist aliens coming down and talking to us theistic humans, and that's the way it normally works, and I tried to flip it on its head. It's like, okay, nice idea. Pity he didn't take that anywhere. So, onto the science and technology part of this review. What do we have here? Oh, yeah, an alien. It floats in a black spaceship. Again, no questions asked about that. And there's the spaceship that it arrived in uses some kind of advanced fusion, which takes into account this fifth fundamental force of the universe. Again, not really. It's not even that it's not explained. It's like it's not even questioned, which is a weird kind of thing with science fiction. It's just window dressing. And there's some other questions, big questions in the book, like, ooh, what about this supernova? Oh, no, that's going to spoil the plot if we talk too much about the supernova, but just let me tell you, there's something about supernovas going on. Why? Well, because we're not talking about supernovas in, like, a discussion between two people. It's happening in plot modes. So there must be something about supernovas. Oh, is there going to be anything about supernovas later on in the book? I think there is. Anyway, so we learn a little bit about supernovas. And also there's these other aliens the Horace aliens. They go and visit other alien planets and they find lots of missing aliens and they go, oh, I wonder where these aliens could be. It's a bit strange because there are some answers given here, but they're not actually answers given. They're actually just the main character going, hey, guys, I've worked it out. It must be this. And everyone just goes, oh, yeah, you're right. It must be that. And then it's just treated in the book that whatever the main character worked out the answer to this riddle to be, without any testing. Hey, this is something that gets wrong with science. You know, if a scientist comes up with an idea, they have to, you know, get evidence behind it, and they have to be able to test it, and it has to be falsifiable in some way. This is a big one. You know, if you read the history of science, you know, Karl Popper, he was all about the, you know, the falsifiability of something. It's like, here's a theory. Tell me something that, if we find it to be true, would disprove this theory. And of course, there's just nothing like that in the book. Everything that's thrown out there is just like, oh, it must be this. And we're like, oh, is it that? And it's like, yeah, it must be this. Oh, okay. You hear that pause? That was where a normal scientist would be like, hey, actually, what is that actually true? How could we work out if that's true or not? But in this book, you just get... you get this big silence of just nothing, of just no questioning at all there as well. It's a bit like in Snow Crash, you know, when, what's his name? Hero protagonist in Snow Crash. He goes, oh, hey guys, I've got this theory. This is must be how it all works. Actually, he didn't even come up with it. He's just told the theory, and he just goes, hey guys, I'm going to repeat to you in a very long-winded way what this other person told me in a very long-winded way, and that's now going to just be the truth and the way that the universe works. It's like, no, you can't just make stuff up or like come up with an idea and then the rest of the book has to follow those rules. The rules have to be laid down, and then you've got to work them out and test them in some way. So no science, no testable claims at all. So the science and technology woefully lacking, and I'm going to go into this a little bit later in the review as well. Reading and the writing. Here's the thing about Robert J. Sawyer. He's actually a really good writer. You know, like in the first book that I read of his, Hominids, it was quite weird that I was reading it and I was going, this is terrible. But, you know, it's a real page turner. You keep turning the pages because he writes in like short chapters, you know, and he keeps you in the conversations, you know, get to the point and keep moving quite quickly, you know, and he gets, you know, he just moves through it, which is quite good. And also, it's good to be in an audio book as well. I can be doing other stuff. It doesn't really feel like a waste of time listening to a book as well. Like I said before, there is this point of view switch, because it's all in first person narrative, and then it suddenly switches. Oh, I mentioned this before, I think. It suddenly switches view to a third person narrative and then switches back, and that's a bit clunky. But generally, the writing isn't bad at all. Like I say, there's lots of stuff that I've criticized him for, but you know, he can actually write a good book. The narration is pretty good as well. I think I've got to the point now with audiobooks, I don't even hear the narration. I think the narration would have to be really, really, really bad before it starts impinging on my enjoyment of the book. It sort of like fades into the background, and it's like I'm reading it in a way, I guess. Although there is at one point, he kept on calling the Earth's sun, he called it Sol. And I've always thought, like, when it, you know, it's in a lot of like science fiction books when they need a name for our sun, it's S-O-L. And I've always pronounced that more sort of Sol, as in solar, like solar energy. And he pronounces it Sol. And maybe that's the way you pronounce it. Maybe email me, luke@juggler.net. How would you pronounce Sol? Would you pronounce it like Sol as in the sole of your foot? Or would you pronounce it Sol as in Sol, the name of the sun? Anyway, moving on to the final... maybe this review isn't going to last very long, I guess, if this is the final part. So, the thematic kind of ideas of the book here. Now, the main idea is, of course, the whole idea is, can we prove God through... could we prove that there's some kind of intelligent designer to the universe... just by the evidence that we have now, and is that a good way of looking at the world? And now, generally, science is pretty much, you know, summed up that actually, no, that's not a very clever way of looking at the world. And you know, there's all these court battles in high school boards and stuff like that in America. And pretty much, whenever it has to go up against, you know, into a court where it's actually being tested, like the ideas are tested, it's always like, actually, no, it's not a very good idea to take, you know, and to come up with these ideas of, you know, of intelligent design and creationism and stuff like that. But anyway, this book is like going, ah, but what if aliens come down and they have like better ideas than us? They've got like, they're more advanced than us scientifically, etc., etc., and we'll be able to work it out. And so that's the main idea, which obviously leads to long, long, long discussions about evolution and the ideas of creative design. Now, if this was, I can't help but thinking, if this was like an honest look at the evidence one way or the other, or the arguments one way or the other, of course it would probably take around about a quarter of the book, and it would come down to actually, you know, like the combined ideas of 21st century science going back maybe like, you know, since the time of Charles Darwin. It's pretty much wrapped it up that, you know, the whole idea of intelligent design, there's no evidence for it. You know, again, you could say that it is there, but again, all of the ideas that the creation scientists and intelligent designers come up with, they've all been disproven or shown to be not right in other ways, or superfluous and all these other things like that. But again, uber powerful alien race comes down. However, still no more evidence for God. All they've got is the word of the aliens, because there's no science there. You know, Horace says, hey, there are actually these other rules, there's this other fundamental force of the universe. We've had eight universes before ours, or we're number eight, or something like that. And what's happened is actually that in one of these previous universes, life arose, and then one of this alien became so powerful that they managed to encode new rules of the universe into our universe, so our universe is more conducive to life. Now, you may have already picked up on what's wrong with this. There's actually many things just in this basic idea, which is the central idea of the novel. This is the one thing that the novel is actually, is bringing to this whole creationist versus, science kind of debate here, that there was another God in a previous universe, and he set up the universe to be, our universe to be more conducive to life, actually to be perfect for life. And I've got this one massive question which just pops up straight away. It's like, okay, so this alien, this massive super powerful alien in this previous universe, where did that come from? Oh yeah, it must have been alive. It must have been life. It must have been created somewhere. And how would it be created? Oh, it must have been a god in a previous universe. And how, okay, so how many universes do we go back before there's no god anymore? Well, the book answers it. Seven universes, and that's the first universe that has ever been. So I'm like, okay, so we've had seven universes, and in one of them, ours, of course, life arose, but we're actually going to blame a previous alien race, which has turned into a god in our race, who rewrote the rules of our universe. And it's like, well, where did he come from? Well, he must have evolved, or that alien being must have evolved as well. So actually, the entire novel, this whole idea of the novel, like the basis of the novel, is like so simply and trivially refuted and shown to be nonsensical, because if life could have evolved in our universe, but no, it can't, because it has to be set up by God. And where does the God come from? A previous universe. Well, that must have been set up in some ways. So there must have been a God before that. Ah, but we only have eight universes. So the whole idea is, I can dismiss it literally outright with like just the argument that I've given there. Which, tell you something, it's not my argument. Other people have made the other argument. It's like, oh, God created it. Where did God come from? Well, he's always been there. Oh, has he? Well, this book fails on that count, because God hasn't always been there, because there's only been eight universes so far. Idiot. Anyway, next big problem in the book that I'm coming to here as well. Humans and aliens are working from two sets of data. And the humans always take the aliens' word for everything. And I'm thinking, well, wait a second, maybe the alien is mistaken about the previous eight universes? Like, maybe there isn't eight universes, maybe there's only one previous universe, maybe this is the only universe. But we just have to take the alien's word for it. And he said, oh yeah, we found this fifth thingy of the universe, this fifth fundamental force of the universe, and we got this grand unified theory of everything. And we've proved with that God exists. And I'm just like, okay, well, I know Tom, the paleontologist, has absolutely no curiosity or anything like that, but I do. So what about it? Where's the evidence for this? What's the reasoning here? And it's never stated. So what it comes down to is like, ah, well, us aliens, we're ahead of you by a few hundred years, technologically and scientifically speaking. And we've worked out that God exists. So, what do you think? And we just have to go, okay, well, you're more intelligent than us. So, yeah, that's it. Then I guess you must be right then, okay? Another big problem that I found here as well, I mean, I think the problem is self-explanatory. It's not so much a problem of the idea. It's more a problem of the writing of the book as well, that we just have to assume that the aliens have actually worked it out and that they have found God, or they can prove that God exists, even though it's weird that they can't. So the halting state problem is another one that I came up with. He says a few times that the universe is a computer program, Now, the idea of the holding state problem is there's actually no way to know how well the universe or a computer program is going to run, if it's ever going to come up with a problem and halt, and it's, you know, if it's actually ever going to, like, deliver it. Now, I'm not sure if I understand the halting state problem like perfectly in this way, but I think something like that does exist here in this thing. It's sort of like, okay, so the universe is set up to play out these rules, and I'm like, okay, so if it is set up to play out the rules, of course God is going to have to come in and intervene. And God does come in and intervene. It's proved that he actually sets off like extinction events across many other star systems at the same time. And also at the end of the book, he intervenes in a big way as well. And I'm like, okay, if God was that powerful to intervene in that way, with that much sort of like, so he's literally being able to go, okay, wait a second, I'm going to stop this computer program and I'm going to fiddle with this rule, I'm going to fiddle with that rule, I'm going to fiddle with this one. If he's actually good enough to do that, he would actually be strong enough that in his previous universe, he would have been able to create the life that he wanted to create now. He would have been able to do it in the previous universe if he's as powerful, you know, if he's actually sufficiently technologically advanced to be indistinguishable from magic, which is actually a quote which is actually used in this book. And the alien goes, oh, well, that's quite pithy, you should write that down. And Tom's like, oh, it's not actually my quote. And I'm like, yeah, because Robert J. Sawyer will never, ever, ever be able to come up with a quote as clever as anything by Arthur C. Clarke or anyone like that. So anyway, I can't remember what I was getting to there. Anyway, yeah, so powerful aliens encoding rules into the universe with no guarantee that they'll be able to predict what's going to happen, yet with enough power to actually do stuff that they can predict exactly what's going to happen in the universe that they exist in. Anyway, another problem, the whole Occam's razor thing, I mentioned this before as well. No, introducing God into the equation doesn't make the answer simpler. It actually makes it more complicated. If you're actually saying that the only way that all these extinction events could come up on all of these different worlds at the same time, if you're actually saying that in a previous universe there has to be a super powerful being which can encode himself into the rules of the new universe that's being popped up, that brings up many, 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 many times more questions than just saying, actually, there's a super powerful alien race in this universe which went round and set off volcanoes and all these different planets at the same time, crashed an asteroid into all the planets at the same time, and did all of that in the same time, not for any purpose, just for shits and giggles. That is what Occam's razor would say in that situation. So, Robert J. Sir, completely straw-manning the idea of Occam's razor. Next question, next problem, big problem about this. For a paleontologist, doesn't know a thing about evolution. It's actually, I was actually reading it going, well, listening to it going, what the hell? He actually brings up the idea that there are no transitional fossils. And I'm like saying, what are you talking about? There's no transitional fossil. This paleontologist is actually going, oh yeah, it's really curious how we have a fossil of a bird, and we have a fossil of a dinosaur, but we don't have any transitional fossils. They're all just single animals. You know, there's never like a half of this animal and half of that animal. Oh yeah, of course, that in the museum we have this whole display of different, you know, equine evolution of this horse, then this horse, then this horse, then this horse, then this horse, and now a modern horse. Oh yeah, and there's Archaeopteryx, and oh yeah, and there's this other, you know, transitional fossil, but we don't have any transitional fossils. And I'm like, what? You just gave an example of transitional fossil. The idea of a transitional fossil isn't that it's like half of this animal or half of that animal. I mean, that is what it is, and that is what people find, but the idea is that fossil hunters can say, ah, seeing this fossil that we've got here and seeing that fossil that we've got here, you know, 10 million years later, if we find a piece of rock 5 million years after the first, like in between the other two bits of rock, and we find the same kind of animal, what we'll do is we'll find an animal roughly halfway between them. So we've got like these land animals, we've got whales. So if we find animals, find a fossil of the same kind of creature around this area, we'll find a whale with small legs. And guess what? That's what they find over and over and over again. These fossil hunters, they go, well, actually, between here and there, there'll be a missing link in between, and it'll be a monkey with a tail, but with an opposable thumb. And I'm just making ideas. And guess what? They go down into the south of Germany to the Jura district of the south, you know, in Bavaria there, and they find those kind of fossils. That's what they find. They find it all the time. And this is not just one thing that Tom, the paleontologist, gets wrong. Like, there's loads of other basic it's not even a misunderstanding, it's a misrepresentation of what evolution is. And he talks about, you know, the idea of like, punctuated equilibrium, and it's sort of like, oh yeah, because we never find these two fossils, it's sort of like we find this animal and then later we find a different animal. So it's sort of like that's rubbish. The idea that we find two different animals and not in between isn't because there wasn't any, you know, things halfway between the two. It's because things, it's just the way it works. You know, if you find two fossils, they can't be the same thing, and they're going to be different from one time to the next. And then they say, ah, well, you know, maybe it doesn't, you know, and it's not just in small punctuated events. Maybe it's not just a small leap in evolution. Maybe it proceeds by quantum leaps. I made a note of this, quantum leaps. And it's like, do you even know what quantum means? A quantum leap is a very small, like a tiny, like a subatomic, completely unpredictable event. And that's not what evolution is. Sure, they're very small changes. They can be very small changes, but then, and you know, and the mutation can be very unpredictable. But that doesn't lead to a massive change in life forms. A quantum leap is something. It's like when a photon changes from one energy level into another energy level, and you can't predict it. It's completely random, and it's one of the smallest things that we've ever discovered. So calling something a quantum leap in this and a quantum leap in that actually means something absolutely tiny and completely random. That's like a very small thing that they point out there, but it just goes to show actually how little understanding of science or evolution this has. Another massive rookie mistake when it comes to creationists and intelligent designers. He goes, oh yeah, and there's this other big problem with evolution. Nobody really knows how life came up. You know, we had this like this primordial soup and we put electricity through it, and it's like, rookie mistake. The question of evolution and the truth of evolution has nothing to do with the origin of life. And the origin of life has nothing to do with the truth of evolution. Now, it might seem a bit strange that I'm talking a lot about evolution here. And it would be a bit weird talking about evolution and all these big problems with all these big sort of quote-unquote problems with evolution that this guy comes up with, this Tom, this paleontologist comes up with. Because it's like it doesn't help in the argument of the God that is postulated in this book. So there was absolutely no point to any of this talking. The God in this book, the way that he guides evolution, is by massive extinction level events. That's how he does it. That's what it's saying. This is what God is like. If there was proof that evolution didn't work and that it had to be guided, we would find that proof. But we haven't. Because it isn't there. And in this book, it isn't there because it isn't needed, because that's not how God does it. He encoded it into the fabric of the universe, and then when he needed to fine-tune it, he slammed rocks into the Earth and into these other planets. So you don't even need to talk about if evolution is there or not, or anything at all. And he actually says in the book, life didn't start here on Earth. Life started on Mars. And you're like, oh, that's great. And then later on in the book, he's going, oh yeah, and there's this whole pesky question of how life started. It's like, the alien isn't even coming up with that. He doesn't even bring that as a point. He's already dismissed that as a point, and now you're bringing it up. And the whole idea of this, there's actually a name for this idea of just bringing up point and point and point and point and point and saying, oh, what about this? Oh, and there's this other thing over there. Oh, and there's this problem over there. It's this problem over there. It's called the Gish Gallop, named after Dwayne Gish, who is a creation scientist, and he doesn't actually debate on points. He just brings up lots and lots of problems, and then as soon as the scientist that he's debating is sort of like points out what's wrong with the problem, he just goes on to the next problem and just goes on to the next problem. Now I'm only mentioning this because I think Tom mentions in the book that he has debated Dwayne Gish, and it's like, or he's debated some science, you know, some creationists in the past. And I'm like, this, all these points that you everything here is trivially dismissed by every scientist ever can trivially dismiss all of the questions that you have here. And you're a paleontologist. This is your job to know this kind of stuff and not to well, you can question it, but as a scientist, when the evidence presents itself, you've got to actually just go with it and then carry on with your work. And it's just really strange. It's like in hominids, how you have this Neanderthal geneticist, this Nobel, I think there's a Nobel Prize winning geneticist who had never thought about the impact of evolution on her own faith in God. It literally took half the book to get to the point where it's like, oh yeah, oh, and I'm a Christian. Oh, and you'd think that actually being a Nobel laureate, you know, in genetics would sort of make me question my faith in God, you know, when I'm like, my entire career is based on evolution, and now I've never given this a thought. And here we've got the opposite way around. We've got this guy who's like this atheist, and, you know, who's never had to question this because it's so fundamentally obvious to him that all of this, what the alien is spouting, what he's thinking about, is utter complete bullshit, and yet he starts questioning it for no reason. Like I say, Robert J. Sawyer could have written a book here where God did exist, and I would have been fine with that. It would have been great, and they could have found in the science, you know, it could have been like science fiction, science fantasy kind of thing. They could have found all of this, but actually what's presented in the book isn't convincing enough, and I don't mind if there is a book. Anyway, finally, oh yeah, big rebuttal, which you'd have probably found out, there's, like, right, I said at the beginning, there's, like, loads of questions come up at the beginning of the book. It's like, oh, isn't it strange that the whole universe is fine-tuned? There's this thing called the anthropic principle, which is literally a puddle saying, hey, check this out, I'm the same size and shape as this hole that I'm in, as a puddle. It's like shooting an arrow into a brick wall and then going up and drawing a target around the arrow with the arrow directly in the bullseye. That's the kind of thing that we got the anthropic principle. And I think Tom comes up with this, oh yeah, this thing called the anthropic principle. And the alien just goes, oh yeah, but what are the chances? And I'm like, that's the anthropic principle. The idea is that there are many chances, but we wouldn't know if the chances were spot on unless the chances were right for us. It's like every week someone has to win the lottery, or someone wins the lottery every week. It's not like, it's just one of those just weird things. Anyway, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give away the ending to the book, because I might as well. I've gone this far out here. I've actually remembered the point why I brought up the anthropic principle, even though this is why this is so like easily dismissed, the whole anthropic principle kind of thing. The weird thing is that the universe is perfectly tuned to show that life is good. You know, water is based on this. Actually, no, that's a bit weird thing, because he talks about water as though it was different from the rules of the universe. But anyway, the rules of the universe are just like this. If that was a little bit different, life couldn't exist. If gravity was a little bit like this, it wouldn't exist. Life wouldn't be a little bit like this. And then, of course, we've got the supernova subplot. And, like, supernovas wipe out life in a whole galaxy when, like, a big star blows up, it can wipe out life across the whole galaxy. I'm like thinking, yeah, fancy that actually. So the entire rules of the universe have been written to be conducive to life, to make life really great and really easy and perfect and everything like that. Except the way that stars explode when they end their life. Wouldn't you think that, you know, if you had control over the rules of the universe, you'd be able to sort of like tweak that rule, that like really small rule which says stars explode at the end of their life cycle and wipe out life all the way around them. You know, it's just such a basic like plotting logic kind of massive plot hole in this book, where the whole main argument for the existence of God is that the anthropic principle is so great and the universe is so perfect for life, and yet the main point at the end of the book is that the universe isn't great for life and there's massive supernovas. And it's just like, oh, come on, like seriously, is this at the level of like inanity? So the ending, I'll give it away, they meet God, okay, however, and I'm not kidding here, in the book, I'm actually trying to think if Robert J. Sawyer is actually playing a joke on anyone, but I know he's not, because if he was, he would have written the book better and he wouldn't have written Hominids afterwards. But in the book, Tom makes references to Star Trek. In the book, Tom gives Horace, the alien, who isn't called Horace, he gives Horace copies of the Star Trek series and the films of Star Trek. Yet at the end, when they meet God, nobody thinks of the quote at the end of I can't remember, at the end of the one that they meet God, William Shatner, Kirk says, wait a second, why does I'm gonna see if I can find this quote on YouTube, one second, because I'm sure it'll be on here. All I need to do is type in, I'm gonna edit this so it's really seamless. One second, here we go.
Then I shall make use of this starship.
It will be your chariot!
Excuse me.
It will carry my power to every corner of creation.
Excuse me, I'd just like to ask a question. What does God need with a starship?
Bring the ship closer.
I said, what does God need with a starship?
What does God need with a starship? This powerful God, who, I'm not kidding, is like one of the most powerful, like in all science fiction I've ever read. All science fiction I've read, this is probably one of the most powerful things. Of course it is, because it has to be, you know, it has to be something absolutely awesome, like God would do awesome. And yet, it's like, I'm literally sitting there thinking, what does God need with a spaceship? And I'm thinking, wait a second, Horace has seen that movie, Tom has seen that movie, why aren't they scratching their heads going, wait a second, what does God need with a starship? Like, what does God need with a starship? And that really sums up my entire review here. Literally, at the end of the book, I'm going, what does God need with a starship? This whole book, it's like, why does this book exist? What's going on here? Is Robert J. Sawyer a Christian? And does he actually believe any of these straw man arguments that he's putting out there? He says, oh yeah, Tom's a bit like Carl Sagan. I'm like, did you ever read anything that Carl Sagan ever wrote? Did you never listen to anything he said? You know, I'm sure he was always like, oh yeah, you know, I'm not going to be an atheist. I'm going to be, you know, agnostic about it. But you don't you understand what it actually means to be agnostic about something? Do you not actually understand science? Do you not understand anything here at all? Do you not understand anything you've written in this book? What are you writing for? What does God need a starship for? What do you need a starship for? You know, it's that whole kind of idea. I'm just going, like, wait a second. This whole film up to now, it's been like God exists, and it's like, yeah, but what does he need the Enterprise for? You know, it's been years since I've seen that film, but you know, it's such a part of popular culture that, and Robert J. Sawyer just misses the point of like the entire book that he's just written by writing the end of the book. So it's going to show, he does actually talk about other themes, like I say, I'm not going to go into them. I was mainly sticking to like the creation and science kind of debate there. I did make this note of the film, make this note of one line, and he's, you know, Tom and is chatting, knocking backwards and forwards with Horace, and he goes, we're engaging in the kind of bullshit session that students engage in late at night. And I'm like, that is the level of the rest of the book, you know, apart from all like the bullshit creation stuff, like it's sort of like going, oh, bullshit student late at night getting stoned and talking about the meaning of the universe. It's that kind of level, bringing absolutely nothing to the table, and in some cases bringing so little to the table that the way he explains moral decisions is by introducing an alien which can innately know what is the moral and ethical thing to do in any situation, but without actually thinking about it. Like, we can see two objects or three objects or four objects and just go, there's three of them, four of them, and you don't actually need to explain it. You don't need to explain one and one means two or equals two. You know, it's that kind of fundamental level that you just take it for given. You know, you take it for granted that four objects means four objects. And these are aliens. They just take it for granted that the moral stance that they take on something is always the right moral stance on it. I'm like, well, that's an interesting kind of alien, but what does it actually mean? And what does it bring to the table? And what answers does it provide? Another thing like that. And we find out that when Tom has this big sort of like moral question or a big quandary, which isn't a quandary at all, it's obviously what decision he's going to make, because if he doesn't make the decision, of course the book can't end. But yeah, so anyway, at the end, you know, near the end of the book, Tom has this thing and he asks one of the aliens, and the alien is just like, ah, well, you've just got to work that out for yourself. And I'm like, oh, for goodness sake, if you're going to say that, like, absolute morality exists and only aliens can talk about it, you might as well say what the alien thinks on something. Or if you're not going to say what the alien thinks on something, maybe, I don't know, it's just pathetic, literally pathetic kind of level that the discourse in this book. So anyway, in conclusion, terrible book on every single level, except it was actually quite, it got to the point where it was so bad, it was good again. And that is a very, very rare thing, that actually something can be so bad, I'm actually thinking, I'm going to read this book or listen to this book, and I'm going to get to the end. I know it's going to be terrible. I know it's going to be painful. I know it's going to be, you know, grinding and tiring to get through, but I know that by the end of it, I will actually have something to say in the review and actually just be able to think and literally read the book and just go, nope, you're wrong. Nope, you're wrong. Nope, you misunderstand that. Nope, you misunderstood that. I was actually wanting it to be a little bit more of an intellectual exercise to pick out all of the mistakes in critical thinking and all of the logical errors and fallacies that he puts into place there. You know, this book is, if you listen to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, they have a spot called Name That Logical Fallacy. That's what this book is. It's literally a handbook to show how inane all of his arguments is. Maybe that's why Robert J. Sear wrote the book. But then again, I'm not sure he did. Because it's like, if he was thinking that, he would have realized that the book isn't worth writing, or he would have written it better, or it would have been a proper theological discussion rather than just like a pseudoscience kind of up against real science kind of discussion. So it's a bit strange. I'm going to have to give it 1 star. It could have got 0.5 stars. But again, it is a book that I did finish, and I'm always thinking that if I actually managed to get to the end of the book, it should be at least... Oh no, I've done this before. I think there was a book that I got to the end of that I gave less than 1 star. So maybe I'm going to give it 0.5 stars. But I think 1 star, because to be honest, this is one of the longer podcasts I've done. I've gone on for an hour now, actually. I'm just checking. So I should finish up. I thought it would go long in the end. It's strange, actually. Halfway through this review, I thought, oh, I've only got a little bit to talk about. But it turns out that the thematic kind of ideas and the science ideas were the thing that I obviously wanted to talk about most here, which is the part that I enjoyed most about the book, or ripping apart, or getting into. To note, I dismiss it later. Anyway, 1 star. The next book that I'm going to read or review, actually, I'm still reading The Game of Thrones, but that's like a book that I'm actually reading rather than listening to. So I'm only reading that when I go to bed at night. I think I'm around about 200 pages into it, but it's like 700 pages long. So I've still got quite a long way to go. Enjoying that quite a bit. I'm not sure what other books I'm going to do next. Maybe I'm going to try. The thing is, I think I've read like all of Arthur C. Clarke's novels. I think I've read all but like one or two of them. So I think I'm going to go back and see if I can find some Arthur C. Clarke books to read. Or maybe I'm going to do some Heinlein. There was the whole kind of libertarian book that I read, books that I've read recently that talk about all that kind of thing. So I might read A Moon is a Harsh Mistress or some other sort of like more political Heinlein book. Either way, not quite sure. If you've got any book recommendations, please keep sending them to me via email. Luke@juggler.net is the way to get in hold of me there. Otherwise, follow what I'm reading and follow what I'm doing on goodreads.com /Luke Burridge. Become my friend, follow my reviews, whatever you want to do there. And also, if you become my friend, I can sort of see what you're reading as well. And I do enjoy doing that, sort of getting an overview of what the listeners of my podcast are listening to, which is good. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge on Twitter. And finally, check out my website and my blog. It's lukeburridge.com/blog for my blog, or /fiction.html if you want to read my books, which are much, much better than the book that I reviewed today. This was nominated for a Hugo Award. Let me just say that. The book that I've just reviewed, you know, you just listened to the whole review, was nominated for a Hugo Award. And Hominid has won a Hugo Award. If I'm ever nominated for a Hugo Award, which is never going to happen, but if I am ever, I'm going to turn it down just on the fact that I'm going to turn down the nomination, not just, you know, not even winning. I'm going to turn down the nomination for the Hugo Award just on account that Robert J. Sawyer has been nominated for the Hugo Award with Hominids and for this book. And I never want to be categorized in the same kind of writer as anything that Robert J. Sawyer has ever been involved with, or at least with the books that I've read so far. Maybe I've yet to read his like masterwork, but I'm just not going to give him any more time of the day. And I'd encourage you not to bother either, unless you're Canadian. And then I guess it's all right, because you're Canadian, and he's Canadian. And I think that's the most important thing about his fiction.